Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Americans' lifespans are changing. Whites are dying younger. Blacks are making gains. The longevity gap between rich and poor is growing, as is the gap between those living in urban and rural areas. We'll look at the numbers and dig into what's behind them. This hour on Point, who lives how long in America and why? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you hear the new data on lifespans? How long do you hope to live? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we will look at the enormous pay packages of top hedge fund managers, closing in on an annual take-home of $2 billion for some last year. But first, joining me now from Washington is Andrew Fennellan, Senior Service Fellow in the National Center for Health Statistics at the Centers for Disease Control. He is the numbers guy. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Robert Hummer, Professor of Sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Editor of Religion, Families, and Health Population-Based Research in the United States. Robert, Bob Hummer, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Andrew, top line, how are we doing compared to other industrialized nations?
So that's a great question. And the U.S. is not doing well. We have among the lowest life expectancy among other developed nations. So we have a 2014 life expectancy of 78.8 years. And that might sound like a long time. But when you compare it to some countries in Europe, East Asia, Australia, they're living 2 to 3 years longer. And so Americans have, 2 years shorter life just for living in the United States.
2 years, is that a big deal in demographic terms? I mean, if you put 2 years in front of me and ask me whether or not I want them, I want them. But how big a deal is it?
It's a pretty big deal. I mean, so moving the needle 2 years at, say, the rate at which life expectancy grows per year, I mean, you're talking a couple decades. So we're a couple decades behind our peer countries in terms of length of life.
And then it's all about who you are and I guess how you live. But I'm looking here at one report that says an American man aged 60, the wealthiest American men, their likely lifespans are right up there with Iceland and Japan, very long-lived countries. But in the bottom quarter of the wage scale, Americans rank with Poland and the Czech Republic in terms of life expectancy.
Right. So that's a great point. There's a ton of variation. So when you take this average number of 78.8 years, that's not necessarily how long any individual is going to live. There's a ton of variation. And wealth, socioeconomic status is an important dimension. And so when you look at some of the richest of the population, they're living sometimes as long as our peer countries. And then some of those at the lower end of the income distribution living, say, perhaps as long as countries in Eastern Europe or other parts of the developing world.
I really want to dig into the whys here. Bob Hummer will come to you in just a moment to do that. But let me walk through some more of these headlines that I've just seen so many lately. Here's one from earlier this year. White women suffer biggest drop in life expectancy in the U.S. Whites and white women in particular have both seen a significant or notable falls in life expectancy. What's up with that? What are the numbers, Andrew?
So in between 2013 and 2014, we actually saw a small decrease in life expectancy by just 0.1 year. But it is significant because we're sort of used to seeing increases in life expectancy every year for the past many decades. So it is significant.
So just the fact that they're going down is head turning in itself, and women within that. Do you have an explanation for that?
I might defer to Bob Hummer on that since it's something quite complicated.
Bob, jump in with us. Whites down a little, but that's the wrong direction. And white women in particular down. How do you read it, Bob?
Right. Yeah. This is a surprise and not a good trend. Even though, as Andrew mentioned, it's a 0.1 year, but it's something we're not used to seeing. And for white women in particular, what we're learning and what we're seeing there is that high levels of stress, in particular, among whites and especially white women who are have low education and low income jobs, the life is very difficult right now. Trying to combine work and family issues is extremely difficult within the American context. Whites in particular have been frustrated with some of the increases in income inequality and the downturn in the economy in the last 8 to 9 years or so. And so I think we're starting to see the effects of those things, especially on people who are quite vulnerable.
Sounds like just numbers, but when you look at it and think, well, why would there be political anger at a given period in time? People are living less long. That can get somebody's attention. Andrew, take us just to the big gender numbers. Overall, men, American men, what's the average American women? Women live longer, but what are the numbers most recent?
So, just as an example, white women in 2014 are living 81.4 years.
Okay.
White men, 76.7 years. And so that's a gap of just under 5 years. And that gap has actually narrowed in the past 20 to 30 years. So if you look back in the 1970s, 1980s, you see that the gap was actually around 7.5 years. And so there's a significant closing of the gap between men and women in terms of life expectancy, men's life expectancy growing more rapidly than for women.
Why do you break it out for whites there? Do whites have a different gap when it comes to male and female than other Americans?
No, not necessarily. I just happen to have the white numbers in front of me. And in some ways, the overall life expectancy numbers for the United States are skewed heavily towards white, since it's the largest population subgroup.
Though here's another big headline that we've seen just in the last week. Black Americans see gains in life expectancy. And I'm reading here, by 2014, the most recent year on record, this gap between whites and blacks had shrunk to 3.4 years, the smallest in history, with a life expectancy of 75.6 for blacks and 79 for whites. Can you give us any more numbers that flesh that out, Andrew?
So that's right. So that's still... I mean, when we think about it, that's still a significant gap,
yes,
3.4 years. I mean, when we compare it to the U.S. underperformance, it's even longer than the two-year underperformance that we have.
Against other developed nations.
Against other developed nations, exactly. But when we compare that 3.4 years to what the gap looked like in, say, the early 1990s, where the gap was 7 years, whites were living 76.1 years and blacks under 70 years at 69.1 years.
That's a huge reduction.
It's a huge reduction. I mean, a 50% decrease in the size of the life expectancy gap.
Bob Hummer, help us with that one. Going from 7-year gap to a 3.5-year gap, that's in the space of a couple of decades. What's going on with the black and white life expectancy there? It's partly because white's coming down, but blacks have come up much more significantly.
Exactly. So I think you hit the nail on the head that we haven't seen the increases in recent years among whites as we had seen in the past. So that's one of the factors. But the other one, and that's been really important as well, is this increase among African Americans. This has been a great trend, and it signifies greater inclusion in the broader society among blacks. Things like increased educational levels, increased levels of income, increased political power, and kind of all in all, just greater inclusion in the broader society. Those things are good for health and good for longevity. So we saw huge increases in the post-civil rights era for African Americans in the late 60s and into the 70s, and we've continued those increases to the present point. A few fits and starts along the way, but these have been really really great trends. The thing though that still is very troubling, as Andrew mentioned, is this three and a half year difference that remains. Is still greater than 50,000 excess deaths per year among blacks compared to whites. So, the issue is not solved. Discrimination has not gone away. But we've seen these trends in lessening levels of racism and discrimination and inequality between blacks and whites, and that's responsible for the trends that we've observed over the last few decades.
Some really interesting elements within here. Suicide rate for black men declined from 1999 to 2014. That makes black men the only racial group in America to have a drop in suicide rates. Infant mortality down. And this one interesting, too. Birth to teenage mothers, who tend to have higher infant mortality rates, dropped by 64% among blacks since 1995, faster than for whites, down much faster than for whites. And then this one, profound change, decline in violence over the past two decades. But people, there's still a debate around this, Bob Hummer. What's the debate around the significance of violence and life expectancy for African Americans?
Well, if you look at rates of homicide, they're still quite a bit higher among African Americans compared to whites, and in large part this reflects the segregated, more highly segregated housing in areas with higher levels of poverty among African Americans compared to whites. There's frustration in situations like that, and when there's higher levels of unemployment and poverty and frustration, you're going to find higher levels of homicide. So it's a great thing that these rates of mortality for specific causes are coming down among African Americans. We hope to continue that, and I think more and more we see gains in education, in poverty, in good housing, and so forth among African Americans and among whites, for that matter. We're going to see mortality rates decrease, but we've still got a lot of work to do. So, by no means is this are these gains anything that we should kind of celebrate at this point in time. These are important gains, but at the same time, we're nowhere close to finishing the job.
We've got a lot more to look at here, not least wealth. What was once a 6-year gap by one measure, now a 14-year gap between rich and poor lifespans of Americans. Robert Hummer, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, please stand by. Andrew Fennellan in Washington at the Centers for Disease Control, Health Center for Health Statistics there. Little Radiohead behind us with their new album, Burn the Witch here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about American life expectancy, American lifespans, black, white, brown, rich, poor, urban, rural, male, female, who lives how long and why. Andrew Fennellan is with us from the National Center for Health Statistics. Robert Bob Hummer is with us from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Tyson Brown joins us in just a moment from Vanderbilt University in Nashville. You can join us this hour. What is it galling to you that wealth and race matter so much in these numbers? How much life Americans get? Does the gap between rich and poor mean we can essentially buy 14 years of life? That is the gap now for some by one measure. And what strikes you in these numbers? Surprises you? What doesn't surprise you? How do you explain the range of lifespans Americans are now facing by the statistics anyway? Wealth or poverty, a big deal, and lifestyles maybe that come with it. Here's an ad for Popeye's Beer Can Chicken Fried.
Down here in the South, there's a little taste tradition that's been tickling tummies for years. It's called beer can chicken. Well, honey, I have come up with that same slow roasting flavor in my new Popeye's beer can chicken. I slow marinate it in traditional beer can seasonings, hand batter it, and fry it up fresh. And right now you get my chicken, fries, a biscuit, and my creamy cayenne sauce for just $3.99. Honey, this is Southern cooking at its best.
$3.99, anybody can afford that lunch? How long are you going to live? Here's a video from the spa, Canyon Ranch. Tucson, Arizona, a woman named Mimi discusses how much she enjoyed visiting the pricey Canyon Ranch, mentally and physically.
The geography here really offered a beautiful spot to walk, reflect, think, figure things out a little bit, maybe throw away some of the icky stuff. and take in some of the nicer stuff.
The ecky stuff. Rich, poor, big difference in how long Americans are living, depending where they fall on that. Andrew Fenelon, I know these are not your numbers, but I'm looking at a Brookings Institution's report here. So that men born in 1920, there was only a six-year difference in life expectancy between the top 10% of earners and the bottom 10% of earners. Men born in 1950, that difference had more than doubled to 14 years, depending if you're at the top or the bottom of the heap. That seems like a huge gap.
Right. Those are huge gaps. I mean, when you're talking about something like 15 years, that's That's sort of staggering to think about. At CDC, we don't actually calculate life expectancy by income. And that's not because it's not important. It's because it's something that's really hard to measure. And so I think they had a really ingenious method of looking at Social Security records that give you information on people's income and how long they're living. And so it's sort of amazing to see these gaps growing to something as high as 15 years, since we really don't see that in other population subgroups.
You mean, Bob, when you look at that, you begin to see this is a big deal. This is really a significant bulk of life itself dealt out in very different portions here.
You know, I agree. This is incredible. And the thing that I always remind myself and remind my students, too, is that these numbers are not just how long people live, but also it reflects huge health differences well along the way. So, it's 12 to 15 years difference between the lowest income and highest income. That's also true among the lowest educated in comparison to the highest educated. And so, like I said, it's not just how long people live, but we see similar and even wider gaps when we look at health differences across these income and education groups.
And this is new, Bob. This is not the case they found for men anyway, and women by another measure born in earlier in the 20th century. This developed over somehow, by the end of the 20th century, this yawning gap had opened up between rich and poor.
Absolutely. The numbers that Andrew mentioned, I've seen the same thing in work I've done looking at educational inequality and in life expectancy as well, as really jumped up since over the last half a century or so. And so these are new, and I think it's a consequence of growing inequality in American society, that the really highly educated and the high income people have all kinds of advantages and growing advantages in our society, while those with much less education and income have many disadvantages. I really think it's interesting that you played the ads that you played, because I tend to think that these are more kind of structural issues, systematic issues that are not so much of how individuals decide to behave or what they do, but how in American life our corporations, our government, and in general our social life has become so bifurcated.
But that structure may have a lot to do with whether you end up scarfing down lunch at Popeyes or having fried chicken or kale at Canyon Ranch. I mean, it may end up, and there's perverse implications as well. Social Security, the wealthy living much longer, which means they are dipping more deeply into Social Security, though those at the bottom are paying in all their lives as well.
Right. The wealthy will collect more years of Social Security after age 62, 65, 67, whatever the case might be, whereas those with less life expectancy on average will collect quite a bit less from Social Security as well. So it feeds into that issue as well.
Andrew, then there's this, the urban-rural gap between urban dwellers and rural dwellers in America. And then, for that matter, even where you're poor, which city you're poor in. In some cities, the poor are living significantly shorter lives than in others relative to their rich neighbors.
Right. So that's a great point. And just to tackle the rural-urban issue, we see a pretty significant difference in life expectancy between those who are living in large metropolitan areas and those who are living in rural areas, about 2.5 years. So similar to what we see in the difference between the U.S. And other developed countries. But if you look back in the early 1970s, late 1960s, there was almost no gap, maybe a small gap between those living in urban areas and those living in rural areas. So this is something that's developed over the course of the last few decades. And we see that perhaps reflected now in the differences in income differences across places.
Let me bring in Tyson Brown, a professor of sociology at Vanderbilt University, studies race, inequality, and health. He's joining us from Nashville. Tyson Brown, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. It's been a while since we've seen each other. I'm happy to have you right here with us. And help us think about this closing of the gap to the smallest, the smallest gap in history between black and white Americans, 75.6 for blacks, 79 for whites. That's about a 3.4-year gap there, down from almost double that in the early 90s. Does that make sense to you? Does it surprise you, Tyson, when you hear that? What are you thinking?
Well, I'm glad we're having this conversation because I think it's really important. And, you know, I think that to the extent that the decline in the black-white disparities in life expectancy really reflect gains among blacks, then this is a really positive sign. And at the same time, you know, it's a bit puzzling because racial inequality in many areas of life have increased over the last few decades. So, you know, take, for example, the exploding incarceration rates among blacks and the widening wealth gap that has been receiving increased attention. And so in some ways, this is a little bit surprising.
When you look around and here are these numbers standing there, what would help explain that? Okay, incarceration, I don't know what that does for life expectancy. I can't imagine it's a great thing. On the other hand, it keeps you off the street and maybe out of harm's way. What would be the countervailing trends that might be closing this life expectancy gap, Tyson?
Well, that's really part of the puzzle. You know, I think that that's the million-dollar question, you know, trying to figure out what's going on. You know, the report wasn't able to get at, you know, the exact mechanisms that are mm-hmm. responsible for this. You know, I think that, you know, another question to ask is, you know, why is there still this large racial gap in health that exists? You know, it really appears that we're adding life to years, or adding years to life, rather, but it's really unclear whether we're adding life to years. You know, so, for example, while disparities in total life expectancy may be shrinking, there are still large racial disparities in active life expectancy, which is typically defined as the average number of years that a person can expect to live without health problems interfering with their normal activities of life.
Yeah.
And there's still racial disparities in health across a number of outcomes. So you can think about, you know, chronic diseases, functional limitations, disability, biomarkers for cardiovascular disease, inflammation, a number mm-hmm. of outcomes. And so as a result, you know, compared to whites, blacks are living shorter, sicker lives. And although it's shrunk to 3.4 years in these recent estimates, you know, I think the point you raised earlier about, you know, is a few years a big deal? And I think I agree with you that, yes, it is a big deal. You know, this means that black Americans have 3.4 fewer years to spend with their families
yeah.
and ultimately contribute to their communities. So yeah. This is a really big deal.
Andrew, turn to Hispanics with us for a moment. They've got some of the highest life expectancy numbers, at least the way the statistics come out. Can you share those with us?
That's right. So in the most recent year, Hispanics are living almost 82 years, 81.8 years, which is just about 3 years longer than non-Hispanic whites, and then by corollary, about 6 years longer than blacks. This is in some ways the longest lived racial ethnic subgroup in the U.S.
But how do you explain that? I mean, Hispanics overall, I think, tend to be poorer, tend to have less education. I don't know about health insurance.
Right. So this forms, you know, what's sometimes called the Hispanic paradox, that Hispanics in the United States have considerably longer life expectancy than other subgroups, despite having lower level of education, lower levels of wealth, income. Mortality for many of the major killers like heart disease, cancer, are significantly lower among Hispanic populations. One explanation that I'm in favor of is low rates of smoking, and Bob Hummer can probably talk about that a little bit more. But that's it's clear that Hispanics smoke a lot less than other population subgroups, and that might actually be a benefit.
Bob, what about the apparent Hispanic advantage in life expectancy here?
Everything I've done and seen, I think it's real. But I think there's three key points. First is that the advantage is largely due to the immigrant generation. So immigrants from Mexico and other places come to the U.S. They're very healthy. I mean, this, you know, young, healthy, motivated people who tend to live long lives. So what we call this kind of immigrant selection. It brings healthy people to the U.S. Second, that if you look across generations, so from the immigrant generation to the U.S. born Hispanics no longer show an advantage in comparison to whites. So the immigrant generation looks to be really special in large part because they're highly selected to come to the U.S. based on their health and motivation and so forth. But the U.S. born Hispanics no longer have that advantage. And then third, as Andrew pointed out, one of the key things underlying the immigrant advantage, as well as the kind of U.S.-born Hispanic parity with whites, is that Hispanics historically have smoked a lot less than whites have, and I attribute that to the penetration of the tobacco industry, really made its headway into the white population in the early part of the 20th century, men first and later with women, and penetrated much less so into Mexico and into the U.S. Hispanic population. So in that case, white life expectancy across the whole 20th century and still into the 21st is not as high as it could have or should have been, largely because the tobacco industry was so effective.
Thanks a lot, cigarettes. We're talking about American life expectancy. Let's go to Brad in New Orleans, Louisiana. Brad, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. Great show. I'm wondering from your guests regarding Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All proposal. All advanced nations have some sort of healthcare access and long-term care access, and we're lacking it. And I'm wondering what your guests have to say about it.
Thanks, Brad, in New Orleans. Bob Hummer, what about it, the difference between U.S. lifespans and those of other developed countries and the way we do healthcare?
So I think it's a great question from Brad. The irony is we spend more on health and healthcare in the U.S. than any other country by far. Now that healthcare is not equal for everyone. A lot of people without health insurance, with a lot of people without regular care, and so forth. So even with the Affordable Care Act now, we've got more people being covered, but at the same time, there are still people that are not. It's, in my opinion, this is a great thing. This is, providing access to care to more people is fantastic, and so it's a human right. At the same time, I don't think it's going to solve our issues of life expectancy in comparison to other high-income countries or across population groups. We've got other data from the UK, for example. When healthcare was equalized in the UK, we saw improvements in health and slight improvements in life expectancy, but continued health disparities, in some cases even widening. So the issue is that the healthcare access, well great and well a fundamental right, tends to come into play on the back end after people get sick and so forth. And what in I think a lot of social scientists' opinions of what we need are more effective policies that come in on the front end, income inequality, housing, education, these kind of issues that help to prevent problems from occurring on the front end and lessen the demand for health care on the back end.
Tyson Brown at Vanderbilt, I know I've only got you for another minute here. What does it all leave you thinking about? Justice, economic structures in this country, policy, as you look at the gaps that remain, and also the movement. I mean, white Americans dying younger, black Americans closing that gap, living longer, and yet big gaps still remaining.
Yeah, there are large gaps remaining. You mentioned policies, and I think that, really there's a growing consensus that economic and social policies really are health policies. And so, it's also important to note that, social and economic policies have created a lot of these issues. So it really stands to reason that they can also be part of the solution. For example, policies aimed at reducing segregation and wealth inequality would likely yield significant dividends. Given the well-established importance of neighborhoods and wealth for one's health, we can also think about other potentially fruitful avenues to explore, like ensuring access to quality education and public transportation, issues like eliminating food deserts and creating safer neighborhoods. So these are some of the issues that I think that a lot of sociologists are turning to as possible solutions for minimizing and ultimately eliminating some of these disparities that we see.
Public policy is health policy. Tyson Brown at Vanderbilt University. Thanks for joining us for a minute today, Tyson.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, a little more new Radiohead here. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about American life expectancy, American life spans. Overall, a bit down at the widest measure, and not nearly as good as many in other developed countries. Blacks closing the gap with whites, but that's it has come up, but that is in part because the white lifespan has declined. Rich heading way out there, now by one measure, 14 years ahead in the top 10% of the bottom 10%. That is a very large chunk of life. You can join us this hour. Does that gap mean between rich and poor, we can now essentially buy 14 years of life? What do these numbers tell us about winners and losers and stakes and economic structure and policy in this country? Before the hour's out, we're going to look at the latest big numbers coming in on compensation for hedge fund chiefs, up toward nearing $2 billion a year for the top few there, and a lot more doing awfully well. What kind of health care do you get? That might make a difference, too. Here's Dr. Josh Umber. He's just opened some concierge medical practice. Here's an ad for it. Atlas MD in Kansas says the standard of care, if you can pay for it, is better than going to a traditional care.
Your standard office visit in our clinic is going to be a little bit more relaxed than people are used to. We take 30 or 45 minutes at a time so that patients don't feel rushed. They get all of their questions answered. We go over their medications, lab tests, really educate the patient so that they're in charge of their own health care.
Nice care if you can get it. John in Glastonbury, Connecticut. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I was curious what sedentary lifestyle versus an active lifestyle has to do with the correlation in life expectancy. You know, as we transition out of manufacturing economy and less folks are doing manual labor and more white-collar jobs, how does that tie into this whole life expectancy conversation?
Bob Hummer, what do you say? And might that even go to the Hispanic great longevity?
So it does. It kind of quite obviously that you know people who maintain active lifestyles and are do live longer than people who don't. It's a really hard thing to get at research wise because you know we're talking about long term activity and long term weight status and nutrition levels and things like that. And so data are much. Much cruder than that, but we're learning a lot, and we know that the obesity increases over the last several decades have not been good for life expectancy, and projections going into the future suggest that this could be really important in stalling American life expectancy, or perhaps even a few have written that this could result in an overall decline in life expectancy. So absolutely, this is something we need to tackle through, I think, policies, again, super important toward, you know, things like providing safe places to exercise and affordable places to exercise and food, you know, healthier food to everyone and not just those at the top. There's a lot of things we could do, but this is one of the key issues of our time.
I like, in a way, the way life expectancy is kind of unyielding measurement here. I mean, you're either sustaining it and making it grow or you're not. And if you're not, something's amiss. Jake in New Orleans. Jake, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you, Tom. And I had a question about family and what impact that could have, particularly this. It seems that a strong, powerful family can really be something that can sustain and perhaps contribute to longevity. Look at Hispanics. When they come to the U.S., they stay connected to their families in other parts of Latin America. They send money back. In addition, they also look for ways to bring the family here. And I just wonder whether family could play a part in longevity as well, too.
Bob Hummer, I'll bring that one to you.
Yes, there's a lot of research that shows that social ties, family, friends, through religious congregations, through neighbors, through others, you know, civic organizations and so forth, all kinds of pro-social ties are important for health and important for longevity. You're absolutely right on that. You know, trying to maintain good family ties is something that's really important.
But I did read here that on the ties back to Latin America, someone's speculating that, well, maybe Hispanic numbers are so high because, I mean, this is all measured, I think, Andrew, by death certificates. If you go back to the old country, as it were, I guess to Mexico or somewhere before you die, maybe you just don't show up. Maybe that artificially inflates the Hispanic life expectancy numbers, Andrew.
Right, so that's a great point. So one possible explanation is that as older immigrants get towards death, they want to go home and be with their families, and so they return to their countries of origin, yep. And their deaths are not enumerated. And then it's also possible that you're leaving just sort of the healthiest group of people still remaining in the United States, and so it's a trend what's sometimes called salmon bias. So this bias of leaving the healthiest individuals here while the least healthy return to their country of origin. It's somewhat controversial, but it's definitely a possibility.
Let me go to Paul calling from Boston. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm a child of immigrants that came from Lebanon. I was born and brought up in the town of Machias, Maine, and we had food from the garden, and we ate animals that were grass-fed and so on.
Yep.
And we walked to and from school, lunchtime and so on. We had no car, and I've done a lot of walking. I rode a bike for 30 years. I'm an educator, and I think diet and exercise has a hell of a lot to do with it. And I gave up smoking at the age of 70.
You didn't rush to that, but you did it. How old are you now, Paul?
95. I'll be 96 in June.
You sound like you're doing awfully well.
Well, I am. I'm legally blind, but I'm doing fine.
Well, there's a little testimony, and I really appreciate it, Paul. Thank you for calling with that, Bob. It takes us right back to kind of basics here. Move around, get around, eat right. If I may, and I'm happy for all those years for Paul. Here's a question from listener online, Stephen on Twitter, interested in estimating life expectancy gains in coming decades due to medical advances. We're hearing about all kinds of super interventions. Might that even further expand the difference between more and less wealthy Americans if those medical advances are not equally, you know, available? Bob?
Sure. No, that's a great point. And I absolutely think so, that, you know, one of the things that money can buy is super high-tech expensive care. It's the highly educated and people with the most income that hear about this stuff first, can afford it first. You know, you're living in the neighborhood where the cancer surgeon is right next door, and she or he has the latest technology available, can share that with you. So, you know, there's great things, of course, in these new discoveries and new technology, but, you know, I think that's actually one of the reasons why we're seeing such huge disparities unfolding in the last few decades is we're paying much more attention and putting much more research dollars and so forth into these kind of high tech and innovations and spending much less time and money and thought about the basics, about minimum wage, about preschool, about public transportation, and about, you know, advertising of pharmaceuticals on TV and these kind of core issues that are, you know, at least correlated, if not causing the stagnation or the loss of life expectancy for those with less education and income.
Well, we've taken it right down to basics. How long a person, an American, actually can expect to live on this earth. And when you do that, it's pretty revealing. Makes you think about all kinds of policies. Really grateful to the two of you for helping us do it. Robert Hummer at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you very much for being with us, Bob.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoyed it.
And Andrew Fennellan, a senior service fellow in the National Center for Health Statistics at the Centers for Disease Control. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
In a moment, hedge fund managers' huge pay packages. This is On Point. A new annual ranking of hedge fund managers shows that the 25 best-paid ones together raked in almost $13 billion last year. The top two earners took in $1.7 billion each last year. That's a lot of money. Alexandra Stevenson writes about it for the New York Times and joins me now. You can link to her reporting at our website. Alexandra, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what's it better to be, a big banker or a big hedge fund chief?
Looks like it's much better to be a hedge fund manager, that's for sure, for many reasons. One, you know, these guys are paid 50, 60 times as much as what Jamie Dimon or Lloyd Blankfein or any head of a Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan gets paid today. But also regulators are targeting these bankers now and requiring that banks rein back their executive pay, whereas hedge funds, I mean, it's an unregulated world, so it's a totally different universe.
Which is something I want to get to in itself, because that means there's a lot of money less regulated out there under these super high paid guys, but without that oversight. You mentioned Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan mm-hmm. Chase chief executive of the bank. Nice pay package last year, $27 million. But look across the street at Kenneth Griffin. He runs Citadel. And what was his compensation, Alexander?
He took home $1.7 billion this year. In last year, over 2015.
Yeah, $1.7 billion. And he wasn't the only one to make that.
68 times as much. He wasn't. Another hedge fund manager, James Simons, who started Renaissance Technologies, took home $1.7 billion as well. And those two actually topped this list last year as well. I should give a shout-out to Institutional Investors, who does this, who calculates these earnings. And they did the study last year, and they found both those two men came up at the top as well, although they earned a little bit less last year. I believe it was $1.3 billion. So
they do it by they do it by investing. We remember last year was a pretty volatile year on Wall Street. So how did they come out of such a kind of a rugged year with such big compensation?
Well, in the case of Ken Griffin and James Simons, I mean, their hedge funds actually performed remarkably well. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple other guys on the top 25 list who lost money for some of their investors and still made it up on the top of the list. And so part of that is because these hedge funds have grown so large in size. And the way that these guys take money is they charge a 2% fee, 2% of the total assets that they manage every year. Mm-hmm. And then they also take 20% of any profit. So in a year where you're losing money, you're still getting 2% of, you know, however much money you manage. And for some of these guys, it's tens of billions. In one case, in Bridgewater, it's $150 billion.
So. We're talking big numbers all the way around. You remind us.
Numbers.
Yeah, in 2001, $539 billion in hedge funds. Now, $2.9 trillion. 2% of that, no matter how you share it around, is a lot of dough.
It's a lot of dough. That's right.
How are the top guys compensated at these firms compared to, I don't know how Jamie Dimon is at a bank? What's the portion for the tip top guy inside a hedge fund?
Well, you know, I think it varies from fund to fund. The average is this 2% and 20.
Mm-hmm.
They call it 2 and 20.
But that's for the firm, and then you decide, I guess, how to allocate it between the people working in the firm.
Exactly. And so the guys at the top and the founders obviously take home more money. And when you look at the list every year, most of the people who make the top are either founders or chief executives. They're sort of in the upper structure. But, I mean, most of these other guys who work there don't do so badly either.
Ken Griffin, now worth a reported $7.5 billion, Forbes estimate. That's a lot of money to move around, to spend, paid, you report, $500 million for two pieces of art, reportedly $200 million for a condo in Manhattan. It must be a pretty nice condo. That's not the only way. But this is a lot. This is a lot of concentrated wealth, and that's not the only way they spend it. They spend it on politics too. Like what? How much?
A lot of them have pumped millions, some tens of millions, into most of the time it's the Republican party. We're talking about, you know, the super PACs and PACs that backed certain candidates, many of whom are no longer in the race, most of whom are no longer in the race. We started out last year hearing about Robert Mercer, who made the list, who works at Renaissance Technologies. He's a co-chief executive, and he earned $135 million last year. We learned last year in April that he was backing Ted, a major super PAC supporting Ted Cruz. And in total, he's pumped about $11 million into the election race, backing others, including Bobby Jindal and Carly Fiorina. That's just one example. But these guys, because they have so much money and they now can put a lot of money behind, you know, backing a certain horse in the race, they're getting involved in a big way.
And of course, Mr. Simons, who you mentioned, put a $9.2 million in 2016 into politics, more on the side of Democrats, including the Priorities USA Action, the super PAC that supports Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
Is the greater regulation of standard banking or banking pushing more money into the hedge fund realm, Alexandra, and therefore pumping up these super big pay packages?
That's a good question. I don't know specifically if people are putting money that they would have put in the banks into hedge funds, but what I will say is that as banks are sort of stepping back from certain practices, for example, lending money to low-income home buyers or providing mortgages, you're seeing hedge funds and private equity firms, these guys who are in the sort of so-called shadows, they're stepping in to take some of that business. And so, you know, and I've written about this, and some of my colleagues have at the New York Times as well, mm-hmm. for example, in the housing space, right? You've got people who are now writing contract for deeds instead of mortgages, and they're these high interest installment payment plans, right? 40-year plus plans for people who just can't get mortgages anymore. So these are mortgages like, you know, that would have typically been $100,000 or less. There just aren't those anymore because the banks aren't lending. It's too risky for them. And so you have these guys coming in and they're making 10% a year. So you do see that shift in a different way. Yes, sort of more broadly kind of where the money's moving in the financial space.
Citadel brought home a 14.3% return with its flagship funds last year. Ken Griffin there, 47 years old, made $1.7 billion. How you doing? Let's watch that risk as well, though, not regulated outside of all that purview. Alexandra Stevenson writes about all of it for the New York Times. Alexandra, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.